You're listening to Better Than Fiction with your hosts, D.L. Nelson and Scott Sackett.
All right, welcome back to Better Than Fiction, your pop culture podcast. As always, I'll be your host, D.L. Nelson, joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
Yo, Scott, this will be episode 430.
Woo!
Damn right, 430 episodes. Or actually more, we've got some unnumbered episodes. So yeah, more than 430, but this is number 430. And tonight we're going to do some cool stuff. And let's, I know we got a bunch of things to talk about, but we haven't talked in a few weeks. So I think what we really should start off with was talk about the passing of an absolute comic book legend. Neil Adams passed away about a week ago or so?
Yeah, I forget the exact date, but it's been about a week at this point.
Yeah, and you know, we knew he had...
He had sepsis. And he had had trouble with it before, apparently.
And he'd been in the hospital for a while, I guess. Sepsis is a...
It's an infection.
It is.
It's a bad infection.
It's hard to kick, hard to, you know, so if you get it, it's not good. So, and with his age being...
I think that's what put my dad in the hospital.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
that's what they think.
With an elderly person, that's not good. But I thought what we would do is, instead of talking about everything he did art-wise, everything he did as far as a trailblazer and fighting for creators' rights, there's numerous articles that have been released about all that. One of the ones, I read quite a few of them, but one of the ones I thought was really good, the Hollywood Reporter had a really good article right after he died about him. So if you're interested in reading about it, that's where I would start. But I thought me and you could talk about a little bit, we've done this before, about our interactions with Neil Adams. I know he's reviewed your sketchbooks and things like that.
But
we also met him at his table before he was Neil Adams Pavilion. He was just Neil Adams Table.
Well, guy. and that's the thing that is a little unusual about it, because he's gone to cons forever. I don't think he ever stopped going. He may have it like at some point.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, but when we were going to cons, he was always there.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. You're right. He was always at San Diego, but I went to...
Well, I don't think he went to little cons.
Well, we went to...
But my point is, his convention attendance was a lot stronger than a lot of pros of his era. I mean, like, John Byrne hung up conventions a long time ago. Neil Adams always went to San Diego. He was going to the bigger cons. And we would see him, and it was literally like he would just get a regular booth, like an 8-foot table kind of booth, like anybody else would get. And then at some point, he blew up. And I don't know if it was CGC stuff. And no. I think it was when people started selling signatures is what it was.
Well, I think two things. So when we started seeing him at San Diego, this is before we ever saw him at Kansas City or Dallas or anything like
right,
that.
Right, we would only see him in San Diego.
But then he did start going to like not just the global shows, but the regional shows also. But I'll tell you, when we first started seeing him and he was signing books for us and talking about his expanding Earth theory and all that stuff, you're right, he had like basically 2 8-foot tables, and it was continuity was his banner.
Right.
And he would talk about continuity stuff and all that. But I'll tell you...
But there wasn't a line.
There was no line.
It was just him, and he was very accessible.
Yeah.
He would sign anything. He was selling books. Yeah, he didn't charge to sign. And then at some point, he blew up. And do you know what made him blow up?
I think in my mind, what made him blow up was a couple of things. You know, he started doing those prints... Of like he started doing variant covers and started doing prints for like
you say like variant covers you mean like sketch covers or do you mean like were they mass printed
variant covers. I know he did some Walking Dead one, at least one of those. He did stuff for Marvel, did stuff for DC. He also did a couple of he did a DC Batman story. He did a Marvel, did he do like an X-Men story?
He did come back and do that X-Men first origin or first
something. And he did the Batman thing where it was like the 8-issue Batman thing.
Yeah, he has come back and done some work.
So he
was after, when we first saw him, his big thing was DC was releasing the Batman hardcovers.
Right.
Reprinting his work.
And we bought one. I bought one every year for 3 years in a row and had him to sign it.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I think what made him high profile again was because he kind of, I won't say he left comics, he just wasn't doing a lot.
Well, he does advertising.
Right, right. So he started doing those limited series, started doing variant covers, and he started making prints of not only the new stuff, but like, for example, Superman versus Muhammad Ali prints, things like that. And he made this print pavilion, and people started seeing all these prints, and you could go up to him and buy a print, and he'd sign it, or sign one of his books he had, and in between that, all of his convention appearances, the guy just blew up, and his signature went from like $5-$10 to it was like basically $30 or something.
Yeah, free. We were getting a free. Well, and what he did is he for whatever reason, his career, I don't know if it was a conscious part on his part or he got lucky or he started doing more work, but whatever reason, he was able to monetize his convention appearances. And when we first started, he wasn't.
I think his wife was behind a lot of that. To tell
probably,
you the truth.
And his kids. You know, he'd get a big booth, like a freestanding booth, in the later years. And I've seen like his sons at his booth, and you know, and his wife was always there doing business stuff.
Right.
But before that, we were able. Before he became basically inaccessible, we were able to. We were able to see him and talk and interact with him because no one was at his booth. I know there were at least two or three San Diegos that we went and spoke to him for a long time.
I would say the better part of an hour one time.
Yeah, easily. We saw him one time on a preview night, and it was the second time we'd seen him, and that's when he was talking about his expanding Earth theory.
Mm-hmm. It was me, you, and one of the guys.
Yeah, there's some of the guy that walked up, and that guy was kind of arguing with him or talking, interacted with him more about that. I was just kind of like, dude, I don't know about all this.
And you fast forward like 15 years later, and there's no way you're going to have a conversation with him.
Not for that long like that.
No, it'd be more like, hey, I really like your work on this book. Hey, thanks, move along.
Yeah, next, generally, along. He's not at the table. He's in the middle drawing, and his wife is like, hey, here's, you know, sign this.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Right.
I don't think he had a handle of the first time we saw him. I think it was just him.
Yeah, for sure.
You know.
So, yeah, he blew up. And then he was also doing, I'd say the last couple of years, you'd see him online and he would do a drawing of, like, let's say the Joker or redoing a cover he did in the 60s or the 70s. And he would redraw it or whatever, or do a Joker or whatever. And you could bid on it or whatever.
Yeah.
Know? And he'd sell the originals and stuff like that. And his wife would be there and show. She'd hold it up and he'd talk about it or whatever. And so, you know, they had a presence on Facebook doing that up until he got put in the hospital. So anyways, big loss. And you know, he was big in the industry, obviously. So pretty much a Mount Rushmore kind of guy.
So I want to talk for just a second about this expanding Earth thing, and I'm reading about it online, and I'm not going to claim to be somebody that understands it, pro or con, but he was really into this, and it basically is a theory that the Earth was small at one point and has expanded, and you know everyone's heard the theory about continental drift and how the continents drifted apart. His theory was. They moved apart when the Earth expanded, and somehow dinosaurs are wrapped up in it and stuff like that. But he was into it so much that at one point, again, this is before he started doing Marvel DC kind of work. He, and I've got an interview, the first issue of Comic Book Artist has a long interview with him, and he talks about how he wants to do a graphic novel dedicated to this, and the premise was there were going to be two guys sitting in a bar arguing about it, and through that he was going to present the theory in graphic novel form.
Nice.
You know, and speaking of that, something else that came out about the same time. In fact, I think the first thing that I saw of his reprints was Marvel reprinted his X-Men work in a trade paperback.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first one I saw, and that probably came out in the mid to late 90s. And then that out of that, and of course, Dead Man's been reprinted, Green Arrow and Green Lantern, and then the Bat. I think the Batman thing was kind of the last DC thing, but anyway. But I thought his expanding Earth theory and his, I don't want to call it fanaticism, but his like I said, he was so dedicated to it or convinced of it or whatever that he was gonna do this graphic novel. But apparently his star took off, and so he was rolled back into comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the CGC thing helped him. You know, he can sign a book and make $30 or whatever.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he was high rolling, man.
Yeah,
I mean his boots were always after that whole signature thing and CGC thing and print thing took off. His boots were always packed.
Well, and to be fair, they should have been packed the whole time, but...
Well, he didn't have things to sell like that.
Yeah, though. They were packed for a different reason, but he was definitely a legend in the industry, and you know, he was a guy that came out of you know, advertising art and cartooning, and he kind of brought a level of professionalism to the field, and everybody talks about, oh, we've all creative rights, all that stuff, but... I'm not really even talking about that, even though that's an aspect of it too. But it's just this idea that you know, comics shouldn't be ran like a club, and the people that work on comics are should be treated like professionals. They shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be like, hey, who can we get for how cheap, you know? And he kind of brought this level of, hey, my talent is way up here. So I'm going to do projects that are way up here, and I'm going to get money that's way up here. And, you know, he definitely, you know, brought that to the room. I was reminded saying that, and him passing, I think, you know, it's kind of like there's one less adult in the industry. But, you know, I was reminded of another thing that I read about, that Frank Miller and Dan DiDio are doing a publishing venture together.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's focused on the Frank Miller thing. I'm kind of focused on the Dan DiDio thing. Because you and I, when we go to San Diego back in the early 2000s, we always heard Dan DiDio talk. He was always on the DC panel. He was always on the Breaking Into Comics panel that DC would do, and I would go to that, and he would talk. And they did one every day, and you had to go to it if you wanted to review your portfolio, because there was a raffle at the end. And so I would see that same speech multiple times most years. But Dan DiDio is another guy that, even though I'm not a DC guy, and I didn't really like everything he did and he said necessarily, He had a level of professionalism that he brought to how he approached comics, and I really feel like Adams had it and he's gone. Dan DiDio had it and he was pushed out.
Yeah, you're right.
Now he's back, and so hopefully this new venture, even though it'll be a lot smaller in DC, hopefully they'll have some of that, because I think that's something that the industry seems to be lacking.
You're right. He did come off as like very professional, a very polished speaker, that kind of thing.
And at that point, everybody did. All the he didn't stand out as maybe a little bit compared to some people, but.
But what? Where'd it get him? They pushed him right out, man.
Yeah, they pushed him out. Well, I mean, because he, you know, he's probably made a good salary, you know, and they were just like,
well. Well, they were taken over by AT&T or whatever, and that kind of thing. And whenever you get, when companies take people over, they look at who they can cut to.
Right, because it's the bottom line. I mean, another guy, you probably don't know him, is Mark Chiarello. He was the art director at DC forever, and he would do those Breaking into Comics panels with DiDio, and he's reviewed my portfolio once or twice, and he was another guy that just And it's not really, it's like comic, there's a professional way to make comics, and it's not really, it's just this idea that it's treated as a business versus, just, you know, hey, we're making them, and we got some wacky ideas, and we, you know, it's, I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain, but the contrast is pretty stark, and I feel like the industry is a lot poorer for it. I read an interview with John Byrne recently, and he was talking about when he broke in at Charlton in the 70s, he was making $50 a page. Okay, current Marvel, their starting page rate is $160 a page. So you could go, oh man, we're making a lot more. But when you adjust $50 for inflation, it ends up being like, I think it was like $260 a page. So he was making more at Charlton adjusted for inflation than somebody breaking in at Marvel nowadays. Mm-hmm. A lot more, like almost double, you know. And again, it's just it's because it's driven by how cheap can we make them versus.
Well, and they're also getting a lot of their artists from overseas.
Again, how cheap can we make them?
You know, if they can get somebody over. But to be fair, some of those overseas guys they got are super talented. So
sure,
you know, it's like, would you want to see some beautiful, nice books from somebody that's an overseas artist, or maybe something that's not quite as good from American guy? I mean, if I want to buy it, I want it to look good, you know.
Yeah, I would argue though that the average is not the average it was. There may be some super talent boys coming over, so to speak, but I think the average quality has dropped. Certainly for Marvel.
Well, number one, there's a lot more books now.
Sure, so, that's true.
So a lot more books means a lot more artists.
Sure.
But on the high-profile books, they've got some good artists on the high-profile books.
Yeah.
And a lot of those tend to be foreigners.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
But, I mean, like I said, if it's going to make a nice-looking book, so be it. All right, you ready to move on to some other topic?
Sure.
So, after seeing Kurt Russell at the what I'm going to call the Cowboy Hall of Fame, it got me to thinking about watching some Kurt Russell movies. I told you I watched the computer that wore tennis shoes. I watched two more.
So
I watched The World's Strongest Man, which came out in 75. It's on the Disney Channel. The computer that wore tennis shoes came out in 69. So here it is 6 years later, but he's still in college. It's the same character.
Yeah.
Dexter Riley. Still there with Dean Higgins. Still there with his buddy, Richard Schuyler, I think is his name, and he's the guy that we saw that interviewed Kurt Russell at the Cowboy Hall of Fame. Professor Quigley or whatever, still there. And at one point, that Richard Schuyler guy, his buddy, says something about, they said, you're still in college? He said, yeah, it's like my seventh year or something like that. So they kind of address why these guys are still in college or whatever. But in this one...
what did you call it? You called it The World's Strongest Man?
Yeah, that's what it's called.
It's the strongest man in the world.
The strongest... You're right. The whole premise of the movie, though, is that Richard Schuyler, if I'm pronouncing his right name right, his buddy, is making this formula in the science lab, and he's trying to come up with a way to... I think they're trying to, like, fatten a cow or something like that. They got this cow that they're renting
for... Yeah, they're like, hey, more steaks.
$15 a day or something from some farmer. And he's got this formula that he's whipped up this stuff. And what he does, he pours it over cereal and tries to get the cow to eat it or whatever. And it's supposed to, you know, beef the cow up or whatever. But through some turn of events... Kurt Russell's character, Dexter Riley's also got some stuff he's made. And at one point, this beaker gets turned over into this... You know how the fluid goes through all the tubes and all this?
Yeah.
Some of it...
the curly cues.
Yeah, all that stuff. And some of it drops into the bowl. And so, at one point, Kurt Russell eats some of it or whatever, the cereal, and real quick, like, he gets, like, super strength. And so what they decide, well, and here's the problem with the movie, and it's a Disney movie and that kind of thing, it's G-rated, but you think it's a Kurt Russell movie, but really he's only in the very front and the very back of it. The middle, have you seen this movie?
No, I don't know.
You never seen it?
I have not seen any of the three Kurt Russell Disney movies. We'll have to rectify that.
Yeah.
Have you seen them?
Oh. So, in the middle of the movie, there's this whole scene where Dean Higgins goes to this board, this cereal company board, and he says, hey, we've got this formula that can make your cereal basically give people, like, superpowers. And it'll last for, like, I forgot how long they figured it would last. If you ate a bowl of it in the morning, it'll last for several hours. And so he's talking to the lady that owns the cereal company, all the board, and he shows them, he eats some of the cereal, then all of a sudden, like, smoke comes out of his mouth or whatever, and, like, all of a sudden, he's, like, jumps up on the table, like their big, long board table. He grabs the chandelier, he's swinging, he does, like a flip like you'd see at the circus on the high wire act or trapeze act. And then he does like a backflip and lands on the ground or whatnot. And then he goes by, he goes to the front of the table where the lady who owns the company is sitting. He grabs her chair by the leg and he holds her up in the air or whatnot to prove how strong he is. And they're all clapping and all this. So they get this idea like, yeah, we'll partner with your school. And what we want to do is we want to put the competitor cereal company out of business. And so, because that cereal company is sponsoring their rival college's weightlifting team or whatever. I know it's kind of hokey. But so he goes...
Dude, it's like a Disney comedy live action from the 70s.
Right. So you get this whole... The rival team has like these legitimate like 30-year-old looking weightlifters. This is in college. One of them looks like Ivan Putski or something, right? And then, meanwhile, on the Kurt Russell's college team, it looks like a bunch of, like, pencil neck guys. And so the whole deal is, and of course, the dean of the other college hates Dean Higgins or whatever, because that's State, and they've got this little bitty college, but State, you know, is the big college or whatever. And so he's like, yeah, you know, we're going to crush you like we always do, and all this kind of thing. So this gentleman's agreement, this bet or whatever. And so they start, and then that's kind of in the middle of the movie. Then the end of the movie... they're going to actually have the competition or whatever. And anyways, the breakdown is it's got like a guy from the competing college goes and he lifts like 200 pounds. The guy from Kurt Russell's college, he goes, and when he tries to pick up the bar, like his arms stretch. His arms stretch. When he tries to stand up, his arms stretch. And so he didn't pick it up, so he got a zero weight picked up. And so the other guys get progressively more weight because they get progressively bigger guys. And so Kurt Russell's teams happen to do like 125 and this and that. So like at the end of the competition, the State has lifted like, let's say, 3,000 pounds. And like Kurt Russell's team's lifted like 400 or something.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And so Kurt Russell hasn't lifted yet because he had to leave. Because I think the formula wore off or something, so he gets in the dean's car, and he goes back to where the formula is, where he's got a bottle of it hidden in the lab or whatever, and he pours some in Dean Higgins' car, which is like a Model T, and then he drinks some himself because the Model T going over there was going so slow, it was like going like people on bicycles was passing him. He puts a little bit in that car and then it drives it back, and when he gets all the way back, of course the car breaks apart. He goes in there. Now he's got to lift like, let's say, 2,000 pounds or whatever, maybe more. Like the bar's bending and he lifts it, and he's only got like 45 seconds to lift or whatever. He lifts it, you know. So that's kind of it. A little breakdown of the movie. But the funny thing is, there's a third movie. The third movie is called Now You See Him, Now You Don't. And I've never seen that one.
I think it's the second. I was reading about it.
Well, it is the second movie. But right. There is a third one, but it actually comes as number two.
Right.
But I don't think it's available on Disney Plus.
Oh, really?
But it's got the same people in it. Same
characters.
Dexter, Riley, Dean Higgins. Cesar Romero are in these movies as kind of a bad guy, sort of, you know. Really, the bad people are kind of the rival college, you might say.
Yeah.
But anyways, but what Now You See Him, Now You Don't, which was a 71 movie from 71, is about they invent some invisible man type of a potion to make you invisible. I don't think I've ever seen that one, so I want to find it and get a copy and watch it. But the other two are pretty good. I think that The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes is better than The Strongest Man in the World. And let me tell you something else. All three of these movies have terrible names.
Yeah.
I mean, all the names are just terrible. But if you like Kurt Russell and you like this guy that plays Richard Schuller, it's his buddy in real life. Cesar Romero, like I said, is in it. There's a couple other notable people in it that you see in the movies also.
So I was reading about it while you were talking about it, and apparently when it came out, New York Times described it as a Walt Disney comedy based on the old magic formula story that served the company well through thick and thin. The new film, which opened in theaters throughout the city yesterday, is nowhere near as funny as the first, but a lot better than the second.
Oh, really? So the Invisible Man movie is even worse then?
They said it's the weak. According to this review, it's the weak one.
Oh, I hate to hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Computer That Wore Tennis Shoes was actually not too bad. The Strongest Man in the World, but anyway. The other Kurt Russell movie I watched, though, that I had never heard of, I don't believe I ever heard of this movie, but I got a copy after hearing about him talk about it, and you said you'd heard about it. I got a copy of Bone Tomahawk.
I can't believe, it's not that old of a movie. I'm surprised
you didn't. I don't remember anything about it. It came out in 2015. And it basically has four people in it. Now, there's a few more people, but the story pretty much revolves around four people. Kurt Russell's character, Sheriff Hunt. I won't tell you exactly what all goes on, but I'll tell you, I'll give a little. You haven't seen it, right?
No, but I kind of know the premise. It was on Prime for a while. I just never watched it.
Patrick Wilson's character is Arthur DeMont, I think is his last name, something like that. Matthew Fox from Lost and Speed Racer fame. He plays a guy named Broder. And then Richard Jenkins.
Richard Jenkins?
Yeah, Richard Jenkins.
Not Swinging Dick.
Not Swinging Dick. An older, wiser Richard Jenkins plays backup deputy Chikargi. Anyways, and so what the premise is these two outlaws are... Okay, this supposedly takes place around like the Texas-New Mexico border in like the 1800s, like when the Wild West was kind of dying down.
Yeah.
And so Kurt Russell's character is like an old sheriff. And then the Richard Jenkins guy, who's even older, is his backup deputy. He's not his main deputy, he's his backup deputy. And then there's these two outlaws out in the desert. And they've killed about three people. They've run across like three people and killed them. And like just to basically rob them. And like take their horses or whatever, or their supplies. They got any money, guns, whatever. They kill, I think it killed like maybe two guys and a woman or something. There's literally nobody around, kills them. And they start hearing these weird noises, and then they start hearing like hoof print, like a
thudum, thudum, thudum,
thudum, yeah, like a posse or the cavalry's coming. So they go to hide, like, oh, we gotta get out of here, there's somebody coming. I mean, you could literally hear like all these hoof beats. And so like they, instead of going out from this canyon, they kind of go through this canyon. And as they go through this canyon, they kind of come out around this, it's real narrow or whatever, they kind of come out in this area, and it's got all these, like, rock formations and stuff stacked up. And what you find, it's like in a circular pattern. And what you find out is, like, that's like an Indian burial ground.
Oh, yeah.
And so they walk through there, they knock some stuff over, and then...
always a bad idea.
Yeah, and they get, and one of them gets killed, and then the other one gets out of there. The older one gets killed, the younger one gets out of there. And he goes to this town. I think the town's called, like, Brightwater, if I'm not mistaken. Goes to the town, and when he gets there, he had buried some stuff outside of town, but the backup deputy saw him do it and told the sheriff that, like, yeah, there's this guy in town. I saw him out there burying some stuff outside of town or whatever, some clothing and stuff. So the sheriff goes to talk to this guy at the bar, and the guy kind of... He didn't really confess he's done anything wrong, but he's like, what do you think, I'm a convict or an outlaw? I didn't do anything. And then the Kurt Russell character just kind of thinks, this guy's up to something. So the guy tries to make a break for it. He shoots the guy in the leg. So he shoots the guy in the leg.
No cops thing. Why are you running if you thing on cops?
Right, right.
Why are you running if you're innocent?
Yeah, so they shoot the guy in the leg. They drag him over to the sheriff's office or whatnot. Put him in the jail cell. And they call up they go fetch the doctor. Now, the doctor is a woman. And her husband's laid up because he'd gotten his leg, I don't think he got kicked by a horse or what, but he's got a really bad leg injury. So he's laid up in the bed with his leg all wrapped up. And I mean, it's like bordering on infected. It's really bad. So she's kind of watching her husband's leg, and he can't go into cattle drive because his leg's all busted, and he may have to get amputated so bad. But they go fetch her, and they say, hey, we got this guy in the jail. Can you come and take the bullet out of his leg? The sheriff shot him. So she goes over there, takes the bullet out. The guy's all passed out, and he's handcuffed. She takes the bullet out, and they leave her there with the deputy and this guy, the convict or whatever, the guy they suspect did something. They leave them in the sheriff's office or whatever. And then Kurt Russell's character goes by to tell the man, hey, your wife's, you know, still there. Well, she says she has to stay overnight to make sure she doesn't get infected. He starts running her of a fever. But I got my deputy over there, and in the morning when we go back, we'll send her back home. She wanted to stay, and the guy's like, all right. So what happens is there's like this commotion at this barn out of town. And so Kurt Russell, the sheriff, has to go out there. Sheriff Hunt has to go out there with his backup deputy because the other deputy's watching the prisoner. So the old deputy goes out there to this barn, and they meet the owner or whatever, and he's like, ah, there's something going on in the barn or whatever. And they go in there, and they find out, like, the stable boy, like, has been, like, killed, like, he's cut, and, like, all of his guts are hanging out. Like, somebody mutilated this guy.
Oh, yeah.
And so Kurt Russell's like, what's going on here, you know? There's some kind of action here, you know? You can tell, like, maybe he's not used to, like, a lot of action, possibly.
Yeah.
So then they go back to, I think it's, like, the next morning, they go back to the sheriff's office or whatever, and the jail cell's wide open, the deputy's gone, the prisoner's gone, and the doctor's gone.
Uh-oh.
And they found, like, some where this person's been mutilated, they found, like, some arrows and stuff. So anyway, he shows this arrow to they got this Indian guy who lives in town. They show this arrow to him, and he goes, oh, man, that arrow, I recognize that. We don't mess with those. Indians don't mess with those Indians. And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, oh, these Indians here from this arrow, these are the troglodytes. And these troglodytes live in the mountains, and they're like cave Indians in the mountains, and they are bad. Nobody messes with these Indians. And Kurt Russell's like, well, do you know where they live? Because it looks like they've kidnapped the prisoner, my deputy, and the doctor. And so this Indian guy goes, yeah, they live, you know, 5 days ride from here is where they live at. It's like 5 days from here. And so Sheriff Hunt goes back to the house where the husband is at, Arthur's at, and goes, yeah, you know, your wife's missing, and my deputy's missing, the prisoner's missing. It looks like they're kidnapped by some Indians. And so he's like, well, we're all going to, and we're putting a posse together. He's like, well, I'm going. He goes, you can't go. Your leg's busted. He goes, I'm going. It's my wife. I'm going. So that's where the posse comes from. It's Sheriff Hunt, Arthur the husband, Broder, which is this kind of a dandy guy. I'll get to him in a minute. And then the backup deputy, which is the old guy. This Broder guy, he kind of like wears a white suit and like a white hat, and he's like a gunfighter. And you find out through the story that like all he does is kill Indians. That's all he does is kill Indians. Like he goes out and kills the Indians, but then when he's in town, he dresses in white, and he's like a fast gunfighter, and he's played like Matthew Fox or whatever. So they go out, and they're going to try to make this 5-day ride in 3 days with this guy with this busted leg. And so the most of the movie is their trek out to where these Indians live at to see if these Indians are in fact the ones that kidnapped these people, and try to get the deputy and the doctor lady back. And let me tell you, it is not pleasant. It is brutal out there, man. It is really brutal. I thought the movie was great. I really liked it a lot. afterwards, there is a deleted scene, only one, but the deleted scene does not change the movie in any way. It takes place after the movie ends.
Oh, yeah.
So at the end of the movie, one of the people in the movie take a rock and they throw it on the ground. On the deleted scene, you see that rock thrown on the ground, and then it goes into about a 3 or 5 minute deleted scene, which plays off of a plot point that wasn't resolved in the movie. It's resolved sort of in this deleted scene, which, like I said, it really doesn't take away from the movie at all. I think it adds to it. I don't know why they cut it, maybe for runtime, but, I mean, it made sense to be in there, to tell you the truth. I watched that, and then there's also, like, a question and answers on this Blu-ray that I watched, where when they premiered this movie at a, I guess at a movie festival of some sort, they premiered the movie, and so there's like a Q&A or a little intro before, then they showed the movie, then they came back and they took questions from the audience, and on the stage was like the writer, director, a couple of producers, and like the three principals minus Kurt Russell. As we know, Kurt Russell doesn't go to stuff. So he did not go to this.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, we're lucky he came to Oklahoma.
Yeah, we kind of are, because he did not go to, he's not going to the Tombstone reunion, didn't go to the 25th, ain't going to go to the 30th, and he didn't go to this world premiere of this movie, because this is the world premiere where they showed it for the first time at this festival. People liked it in the theater. I liked it. And the people that were in the theater, most of it seemed like they might have been reporters, but they were asking pretty decent questions. I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched part of it. But one thing that was interesting was the guy that wrote it and directed it, he'd been a cinematographer for a bunch of movies and said, yeah, you know, I can make the shot look good, but if the script's not any good or if the actors don't care, it really doesn't matter. And I kind of got tired of doing a cinematographer. So, and he'd also written like something like
that. Yeah, he didn't have control over stuff.
Right. And so
he's kind of at the mercy of the director.
Yeah, and it's like he tried to make it look good, but, you know, other things played into it. So
he couldn't influence the script or the acting.
Right. So he kind of got soured on that. So he was also a screenwriter, and he'd wrote like, I think he said he did 21 or 22 movie treatments that had been bought and none of them had been made yet.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was very depressing for him. And he'd also done music.
That's kind of Ellis Goodson's dream, I think. I don't know if he cares if they get made, but sell them. Yeah, okay. He wants to sell them.
Well, this guy was doing that. And then he was also making some kind of music. Like, he might have made an album or two, it sounded like. Well, then he got his business partner and him decided he was going to... He wrote this movie, and they decided to make it. And he had, like, people wanting to invest or whatever and said, oh, you can't make it for this amount of money or whatever. He said, yeah, I made it for a sixth of what everybody else said I could make.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like a Kevin Smith kind of a thing.
Yeah. You
know, just made it really cheap, shot it in 21 days, in 70 different locations, which they're all kind of outside in the desert for the most part, but 70 different spots. And I thought it looked really good. It was, of course, it has like top actors in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was pretty cool watching a little bit of the behind the scenes thing or the questions and answer thing. I recommend it. It's called... Bone Tomahawk, and there's a reason why it's called Bone Tomahawk. So yeah, if you can get a copy, check it out. Worth seeing.
Cool. Sounds interesting. Yeah, I've heard some things that have kind of put me off watching it, to be honest with you. You know,
because it's a Western horror story.
Yeah, I've heard it's pretty gruesome in spots.
It is gruesome. It's a Western horror story.
Yeah. With troglodytes.
The troglodyte Indians are...
pretty brutal.
Different. Yeah, they're different, all right. What would it remind me of? You know those movies that... where they... I'm not going to say capture and torture people movies, or those horror movies.
Like a Saw movie?
Well, it's not like that, really. It's a Western, but there's elements of something not...
man's brutality to man.
But yeah, but they're not, they don't have any like inhuman strength, or they don't have anything.
No.
There's nothing supernatural about them. They're just a clan of the Indians that live in the caves that I'm sure there's inbreeding going on. From one scene you see, it looks like some inbreeding kind of stuff going on. And they've got they've got like a hole in their throat. They've got like some kind of a bone thing here that they kind of make this whistling noise through. That's probably the supernatural part.
Oh, really? Like a trach or whatever.
Sort of. I would consider that.
Bro, what's the thing where they go da da da?
Yeah, that would be like the supernatural part of it, I guess, if you want to say that. Although at one point one of those gets cut out and used by a regular person. So.
Oh yeah.
Anyways, I dug it. So there you go. Bone tomahawk.
Cool. So I'm gonna tell this story out of order, to for dramatic's sake. As Kurt Russell said, don't never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Oh yeah.
But recently I woke up and I had this urge, not an urge, because this wasn't something I could do, but I just had this was last Saturday, and I thought, you know, today would be a great day to go to the mall and go to Suncoast Video and buy some anime. Now, obviously, Suncoast Video is out of business. Did you ever go to Suncoast Video?
Oh, yeah, many times. Although, I don't think I ever really bought anything there, because it's always kind of pricey. Did you ever buy anything at Suncoast Video?
Yeah.
It was pricey, though.
It was kind of... So here's what I'm going to talk about. Because Suncoast Video, at the time, at least around here, was one of the few places that had, like, a dedicated anime section. Mm-hmm. And you could buy stuff... And it was kind of pricey. I don't know if they ever sold DVDs. I think they went out before DVDs, maybe.
You think it was just videotapes?
I think it was mostly, their heyday was definitely in the videotape era.
Yeah.
Either way.
Probably pre-Amazon then?
Oh, absolutely pre-Amazon.
But Amazon's probably the one that knocked them out there, right?
Well, okay, so I think... I don't know. I don't know there's a YouTube channel, and I forget the name of it, but when my wife and I were both working from home during the height of the pandemic, we watched YouTube videos during the day at lunchtime, because there's nothing on TV at lunchtime. And so we'd watch YouTube videos, and one of them I found was something, I think it was like abandoned brands or something like that. And it told the story of businesses that were now out of business. And they may have one, and it would tell you, like, what happened. Like, what happened to Chuck E. Cheese? Or what happened to Godfather's Pizza?
Both still around, by the way.
Oh, are they? Okay. Anyway, but and sometimes, I think it talked about brands that were still around. But anyway, they might know about Suncoast Video. But anyway, so I've kind of been on this, and I sell that to say I've kind of been on this, not just an anime kick, like, hey, let's watch some whatever's on whatever, but kind of an old anime kick, because I did buy some anime at Suncoast Video back in the day. There was a series that I bought called Giant Robo, and I would buy a videotape occasionally about it. But anyway... So I'm a member of a Facebook group called the Golden Age of Anime, and it's anime like from the 80s. It's basically like early 80s to like early 90s. So it's kind of this era, like Robotech would be in there. I don't know if Speed Racer would be in there. I think Speed Racer is probably too early. But anyway, so people are always talking about it. So somebody on there posed the question, hey, what's the most 80s, because it's very 80s-centric, this group. What's the most 80s anime series? What's the most 80s anime? Also, it's dedicated mostly to series, not movies, because at the time it was series. They did a thing called OAV, which was original anime video, and it would come out on videotape. And that wouldn't be the movies. It'd be original. It would come out on tape. This is OAV. And so somebody said, or a lot of people said, their pick was an anime called Bubblegum Crisis. Have you ever heard of that?
Hells no.
Okay. I have heard of it because there was a role-playing game out about it. Also, Adam Warren, do you know who Adam Warren is, the comic book artist?
I don't think so. What did he do?
Oh, he did Dirty Pair, and he's doing... I heard of that. He does a thing called Empowered now.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, he
the
did...
The blonde-headed girl?
Yeah, with the, well, it's the superhero girls. I mean, it's, yeah. It's superheroes. I think one of them is blonde.
Yeah.
Anyway, he did a original story of Bubblegum Crisis. Knew that, didn't know much about it, so I watched it, and it's out. So, okay, well, one of the things, let me talk about the production of the series. It was put out by a company called UMEX, and UMEX was a like an art studio, and what they did is they did it different because they weren't an animation company. They designed it and they wrote it, and they'd hire out the animation, which is a little unusual for them or for the time in Japan with the animation. But anyway, they did it, and they originally and they had done the guy that ran it. I'm not going to attempt to say his name. He had done a couple police things. He kind of wanted to do like a police thing. He's always interested in police. So he'll do a police thing. Nothing. He had a couple things that did well. But he was going to do this. And they found a sponsor at the time. Robotech was really big. And Robotech was big because there was a model sponsor that would make the models. And they would sponsor. They would pay for the shows. They would sell the models. It was a big deal. Made a lot of money. So he was trying to find a sponsor. So he found a sponsor, and so they did this. They started coming up with the scripts and the character designs and stuff. Well, they were pushing them to have more like jets because Robotech was big, and so they're like, oh yeah, we need more jets, and like no. Well, then the sponsor ended up backing out. So they changed the story. Instead of it being like big robots and stuff, it became this story about these four girls that are called the Night Sabers, and they are mercenaries, and they basically wear armor like Iron Man. They kind of look similar to Iron Man, more Japanese, obviously, and they're female. But originally they're going to do 13. They lost their sponsor. They were going to do 13 episodes. They backed it down to 8. And in Japan, what they would do is they'd do one a year or maybe a couple a year, but it wasn't like a television series where it all comes out. This came out over, these 8 episodes came out over several years. From let's see, when was it? 87 to 91. So it was over 4 years. They would come out on tape. They would do one episode. Episode was like an hour roughly, so it wasn't like movie length. But they would sell them. And originally, I was watching kind of a background video talking about it. Originally, when they sold the original videotapes, would sell for like $60 a piece. So it was kind of an expensive proposition. You talked about Suncoast Video being expensive. I remember their anime was kind of pricey. I was buying the giant Robo tapes. I think at the time, I think I was paying like $25 or $30 for them, you know. And they were like an hour, same kind of deal, like an hour episode.
Very expensive.
Very expensive proposition to get the whole thing. Luckily now, there's a YouTube channel you can watch. I found on YouTube in English, remastered, you can watch. It's like one video of all 8 episodes. It's like a 6-hour video or whatever. Anyway, but the story is, I say all that to say the background. The story is in 2032, not far from now. Now, there's been an earthquake in Japan. Tokyo's basically hadn't been leveled, but there's like a split in Tokyo. And there's a mega corporation called Genome that builds these cybernetic organizations called Boomers. This series was influenced a lot by two movies that came out in the 80s. Blade Runner, of course, influenced a lot of stuff, and The Terminator. And so the scenario is kind of a mashup of the two, if you don't think about it that way, because these boomers were these, they looked human, but at some point they would generally like break free of their skin, kind of like how Terminator does, and they're these basically super-powered robots or super strong robots, virtually unstoppable. There's a police unit that's dedicated to combating them, but they're ineffective, and so these boomer or these Night Sabers will go after the boomers, and that's kind of the series revolves around them attempting to subdue these boomers. Not all the stories are, or not all the episodes are geared around boomers. There's one of them where there's a guy that's in kind of a superpowered car that he's basically out killing motorcyclists. He's fed up with motorcycle gangs, so he's out killing motorcycle gangs. He's kind of in a car, kind of like a Knight Rider kind of car. You know, it's real tough, and it's got weapons and stuff, and he's taking them this out.
Is Michael.
Yeah, no, he didn't talk to it, but I mean, it's yeah. Anyway, but they take that out. There's one where there's a vampire, and one of the four girls all do different things. Like one of them's a cop, one of them runs a store, one of them is like a pop star. I forget what the fourth one does, but one of them becomes friends with somebody, and everybody's suspicious that this person, there's something wrong with them. But anyway, I'm really digging it. It is very much your, I mean, when I say to somebody like you who doesn't watch anime, certainly doesn't watch newer anime, hadn't been exposed to anime, hey, it's anime, it's probably exactly like you're picturing in your head.
Oh, really?
You know, big eyes, small mouths, you know, V noses, you know, that style. The robots and all that kind of stuff is, you know, straight up lots of, you know, explosions with, like, you know, wiggling flames and stuff. But it's really, really cool. I've been digging it. The series is out. They've done a remastered one on Blu-ray. I may pick it up. It's like $30. So by comparison, it's cheap compared to back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got all of them on it. But in the meantime,
episodes again?
There are 8 episodes, yeah. And then they did like a sequel and 2 prequels.
Okay,
but everyone says no, the original one was the best. But and it's called Bubblegum Crisis because the guy that created it, he wanted the idea that the city of Tokyo was in this tension and was always ready to explode, like bubble, like if you blow gum, like bubble gum, getting ready to pop. And so that's where it came from. I think it sounds like something that somebody come up with that maybe English wasn't their first language or whatever, you know, kind of a,
absolutely,
kind of a mangled English thing. So in English it sounds really weird, but when you know the reason it kind of makes sense. But anyway, I've been watching those. I started I've been watching them a little bit here and there, but it's pretty cool. I dig it. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, anime or classic anime or whatever, it's easy to find on YouTube. So
that's pretty cool. I will have to see if I can find that.
Yeah, I know you're just dying to rush out and watch that.
I mean, I don't hate anime. I think my problem is, it's not the way it looks. It's like, is the story going to be captivating enough for me to get into it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, if I can get into it, it's only 8 episodes, I could watch it.
Yeah.
So the artwork has nothing to do with it. It's like, is the story going to be solid? Name might be putting me off. Artwork might put me off. But is the story good? If the story's good, I mean, I can get by that other stuff, you know?
Yeah. I thought it was pretty good. I haven't watched all of them. I've watched 6 of the 8.
So, oh, really? Okay, so you've seen most of it.
Yeah, I've seen most of it.
How would you compare it to, like, Ghost in the Shell?
You can't compare because Ghost in the Shell's a movie, and so it's like a
They did a TV show that with, like, episodes.
Yeah, you know what? The episodes I've seen of Ghost in the Shell, I think I like this better.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I do.
That's kind of big doings.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you said, how's it compare to Akira? It's like, well, you know, Akira is like one of the best anime movies of all time. you know, Ghost in the Shell's up there. You know, it's definitely not that level of production. And
right.
And like I said, it's 8 episodes, and some of them are better than others, so it's kind of hard to compare the two.
It's not a big commitment, though. It's, if it's on YouTube, then that's, you know, that's a
yeah, I think the whole YouTube thing is like 6.5 hours.
So if you buy it for $30 on Blu-ray, what are you getting extra? Better quality looking, maybe?
Yeah, it's better quality looking. And someday they may shut down. I mean, somebody's going to find out they got that on YouTube and crash it.
That's the thing, you know. You could say to yourself, hey, do I need to buy this stuff on Blu-ray now when a lot of it you can stream? But then again, there might be a point where what you're liking now that you can stream might not be on there forever.
Oh, absolutely. Or, so, you know, we've had our internet go out. And, I mean, our internet, it went out not long ago, and we didn't have the internet for like 2 days. And it wasn't anything in our house even. It was like down the street in the box. The guy was like, oh, yeah, you know, there was something on the thing. And it was only affecting us. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just a fan of physical media because you have it and you always have it. No one can take it away from you.
Right.
They can't all of a sudden go, oh, you know what, that's racist because they showed them with these Japanese people with big eyes and a small mouth. And so we're going to take that off. We're going to ban that. Well, if you own the Blu-ray, as long as you have a player, you're good to go.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, I watched that Bone Tomahawk, and I could have rented the movie. I got the Blu-ray for pretty cheap, actually. If you rent the movie, it would have been about what I paid to buy it. And yeah, buying it, I got the deleted scene you wouldn't get, and I also watched that the Q&A thing you wouldn't get.
I think there is some extra stuff in the DVD, but I don't know. I mean, stuff I like, I buy it.
Right.
You know, if there have been times in my life where I couldn't afford whatever I wanted. Not that I can afford anything I want, obviously. You know, I mean, obviously there are limits, but I can afford to go buy a DVD if I want.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's not like it's like, I mean, more than anything, it's like, do I have room in my house for it?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like,
my shelves are over. Rack, yeah. You see I have a stack on my DVD rack over there.
I'm looking at both your DVD racks.
And both of them have stacks on them.
Yeah, both of them are.
And there's DVDs under the TV.
So do you get rid of one when you have one?
No.
Are you not there yet?
No, the stack's a long way for the ceiling.
Oh, I know.
I have had my shelf fall over, though.
Yeah, that'd be a mess.
It was bad. It was bad.
Let's do this. Let's end this episode right here. As always, I'm your host, D.L. Nelson, joined by my other host,
Scott Sackett.
Come back next week for another all-in episode. Check out our blog at betterthefictionpodcast.blogspot.com, where I'll post a few photos of what we've talked about tonight.
And if you enjoy this podcast, please take a second to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. This will help other people find the podcast.
And with that, we'll say, hey, see you next time. And we're out of here.